Chris is going to introduce the new staff that we'll be working with.
Yes, hi. So, hi everybody. Thanks for coming. So I wanted to introduce a couple new people. First off, Matt Melkerson. He is the acting deputy director right now. I don't know if everyone has heard, but Carrie Sanders has taken on a new position in Montgomery County. So it's an incredible loss of experience and wisdom, but Matt is in her place acting right now. So you'll see him a lot more. This is Ramiro Rios.
Hello.
He's our new principal planner and in transportation planning. He'll be focusing on mostly long-range planning, and one of his responsibilities will also be to manage the Transportation Commission. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about?
I can just give like a 30-second overview. I've been with the city 11 years. Started out kind of in traffic engineering, doing traffic studies, things like that. 5 years I spent doing development review, and then the past 3 years I've been the division chief of traffic operations, kind of overseeing the maintenance of signs, signals, pavement markings, parking meters. So I've got a lot of experience with the city, brings back all these meetings, kind of bring back some experiences when I was doing development review where we had a lot more meetings. So I've got big shoes to fill. But at the same time, I'm kind of looking forward. Jan's already got the position posted to when the new permanent position is hired. So,
welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Sure. And my name is Ramiro Rios again. I have been with the city, a city employee, for about 3 weeks. So give me a break. In the past 5 years, I've been working in mainly at the World Bank and at the Inter-American Development Bank, specifically in transportation projects, non-motorized projects, mainly metros, and how to plan metros better for providing access, you know, kind of like planning metros as a system that can connect to other systems. So I'm an urban planner, transportation planner by training, and I'm very excited to be in the city.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
We also have Quanice Lawson. She's our new admin for the office. So she'll be setting everything up and everything. So.
Okay, we'll get started on the agenda. Before we get started, you know, I'd mentioned to you that you know, some of the items didn't have any links to them.
Right.
In the past, when possible, if you could provide, you know, the briefings that we're going to receive, that way we can take a look at them, you know, kind of conjure up some, you know, questions ahead of time rather than do that. Mm-hmm. It just makes it, gives us, the commission, a little more time to consider that. Yeah. Even if it's just a quick summary on there. If you look at the past, it was kind of a empty note there when I saw
okay.
that day.
Yeah, but, yeah, no. I mean, the reason we didn't provide memos this time is because these are the items 3 and 4 are staff updates, and so they're presentations that are given, and there's no actual action for the commission to take. But if you'd like, we can.
Yeah, if we could, if you could set up those for a link, just so it gives us kind of a heads up, so we can, you know, take a look at that, and mm-hmm. you know, if we have any questions, then we got some time to think about it there.
Sure.
Okay, minutes. Does anybody have any input to the minutes, any changes? None. Even I was surprised. I couldn't find anything. And I wasn't going to read it twice to look for something.
Well, okay. We also sent them around in July, so.
That's right. All right, I need a motion to accept the minutes.
Motion to accept is presented.
Second?
Second.
Okay, minutes are accepted. Okay, updates to receive. We got the 2-year CIP schedule. You want to give us a...
Sure, yeah, I can talk a little bit about that. So so usually about this time of year, we are frantically putting together the budget for this coming year. Last year was the first year that we started a 2-year cycle for the capital improvement program. So this is a very light year as far as capital projects go and any changes to the CIP. So just kind of as a reminder,
this isn't the year to bring up new projects, but if there's projects that need to be tweaked a little bit, for example, if there's a project that has changes in, say, state funding or federal funding, then we'll change that a little bit. But or if there's specific reasons why projects should be changed, that's fine. But if you have new projects, that's great. We want to hear them, but we can't add them until next year. So just to remind everybody. And this is the first year we're doing this, so it's
kind of right.
Yeah.
It's out of sequence of what we're used to. Mm-hmm. Capital Bike Share expansion, the only note I have is in the paper, I think it was yesterday, DC is implementing a new bike share program where the bikes can be left. Mm-hmm. I guess it's big in China and it works. But
According to the article, yeah, it was a rather robust system.
It is. So they're expanding it to several big cities in the U.S. And mm-hmm. and that's a system where you go to your app, you find out where the nearest bike is, you go, you know, pick it up and it unlocks, and then you can leave it, you know, wherever, mm-hmm. and go from there. And I don't know how that'll work out. It seems to work in other places. And as a side note, I've been reading where Baltimore is having a big problem with their bike share program because the thieves have figured out a way to
overridden the system. Yeah.
get a bike. Out. So
do we have much theft of the bicycles, or do we have a pretty even exchange?
No, there's been pretty much no theft in Capital Bike Share. I think the only thefts are maybe stealing a bike from somebody who's already checked one out, but that also happens.
So we're not experiencing the Baltimore problem. I read the same article.
All the history I know of talking to them.
I think we've lost two.
That's not bad at all.
Something like that. Yeah. It's really, really astounding. Well,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the bikes, the Capital Bike Share bikes, they're very heavy and kind of clunky, and then they're actually intentionally made so the parts don't fit other bikes.
Mm-hmm. On purpose.
Yeah.
Safe routes to school, any questions on that? I think that was a good summary there. Okay, we'll proceed to commission updates. I guess we'll stir around the table.
Nope.
We've had 2 months, but nobody's probably been meeting. Anybody have any updates?
So the Intelligent Transportation Systems Work Plan Group met. They had a big meeting over near the DASH headquarters. And, I attended, and it was really good meeting. A lot of good thoughts were, discussed around the table. And this basically would upgrade the backbone of ITS infrastructure in the city to include, a lot of camera systems and abilities to change signal timing, as traffic conditions warranted throughout the peak periods and stuff like that. So a lot of active service management, as we call it, where we're that to enhance present capabilities. So that plan is still, being worked on presently. So there'll be updates more in the future.
Okay. Anybody else?
A few items. From the DASH meeting last week, the pilot session that I mentioned in the, I believe it was the July meeting, or the last meeting that we had was July or June. The pilot program for the Alexandria City Public Schools, right now the pilot program is being implemented with only TC Williams as the target to see how that works, and TC Williams students will be allowed to use DASH with a no-charge basis by showing their student ID card, and we'll see how that goes with respect to ridership and what impact, if any, it has on revenues. And also the DOT Metro Access program will be initiated October 1st. That will enable people that don't necessarily need a Metro Access vehicle itself because of their mobility impairment, they could use the DASH bus system with showing their card and use the system to go to and from whatever medical treatment or services they may need. And there have been some realignments of the bus operation beginning October 1st also. The AT5 is being realigned to make better use of the Old Town area during the rush hour, and 18-9, I believe it is, the route is being realigned to provide better service to Northern Virginia Community College and the Alexandria campus, as well as the Mark Center and Bradley Shopping Center.
When's the trial period for T.C. Williams?
They expect that to go for a year.
Okay.
The school year.
It started
at the beginning of the school year and will run for the duration of the school year.
Is there a plan eventually for reciprocity between the student bus pass program in Fairfax County and Alexandria?
That wasn't specifically brought up, but it would be an option that I think would make sense to pursue. But I did mention the success that you've had over in Fairfax County, and I think Josh Baker, if he hasn't already, will be reaching out just to get some input on how the system works over there.
Yeah, our latest is it's about 5% of riders. Mm-hmm. So.
Can you give me a brief synopsis of how Fairfax does this for students?
So they register with their school admin person, and they have a form that their parent has to sign, and then it's turned back into the school, and then they're issued a card that changes color every year. And because there's not a standard student ID throughout Fairfax County, so there's, because of the student bus pass program, there's actually sort of a push for that. But we have a school rep, Tom Italiano, who administers the program with us in conjunction. And we do a lot of like outreach events at each of the schools, and we had like a pilot phase, like sound like they're doing now, but at I think five high schools initially, but now it's every high school, middle school, as well as homeschool and private schools eligible students, so they can get it, and it's good for the from August to August, and we expanded it to be good on weekends as well. Not quite all day. I think it's like 8 to 8 or something, or like 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. But the intention is that it's for after school activities or jobs or something like that. We might have actually taken the time restrictions off, but you know, it's also good for through the summer. So like when I was doing the outreach events, I would say, you know, this is great for like summer jobs or other activities. And, a lot of flexibility, so the parents don't always have to necessarily carpool the kid to what they need to do. So.
Yeah, I ask because Arlington has a iRide, the program that they offer, but it's the registration for it is a little different. It's not through the school. It's the parents bringing the students to a place where you would buy a smart trip card, but you can, I think they are essentially showing evidence of their age, and recently Arlington expanded that age brackets. There was an awkward chunk of ages between the free kids who were really young and then the kids who were in the iRide program. It was discounted, and in between they had to pay full fare.
Right.
And there were parents trying to like ride with their kids on the bus and couldn't understand why these kids had to pay
full
fare.
We've gotten a few complaints about that, like, well, why isn't it expanded to elementary school kids?
So Arlington recently bridged those gaps, so it's like free to a particular age, and then iRide goes through high school, essentially, high school graduation, but I think it's more age specific than like year, school year, and school affiliated specific. So I think it kind of fascinates me because the intent is to make this option good for the student as a part of a family who might be getting around, as well as the student as an independent potential traveler who might use the public transportation system to get around. And I would just love to hear the comparative story of how each of these jurisdictions, Fairfax, Alexandria, and Arlington, go at it, and maybe even bring in DC and have them talk about how they do it, because I think we could learn from each other, and I would find it really interesting.
And age is tricky, because I think we're technically up to 26, because we have some adult ed programs and alternative programs and stuff.
Yeah, and I don't know how IRAD would treat that or not.
Right.
I'm not quite sure.
And we've heard sort of, you know, anecdotally that, you know, we suspect someone's older adult parent or relative is using the card, but, you know, our official policy is not to have fare disputes, so we kind of just...
Yeah, and like the iRide cards, they don't have an annual change in color, but they do look different than the regular smart chip cards, so if an adult were trying to use it as to get that student fare or that young student fare, sort of like primary and secondary school, it might be suspicious, but yeah, I don't know about how they're enforcing that.
And we put some thought into the card. Like, it has some fraud proof measures where it would be a little challenging to duplicate, and it's like a nice stiff plastic card and stuff like that. So it's not something you can just photocopy. You know?
Right.
So.
Right. Cool.
And Steve,
yes.
Is DASH considering expanding it to the private schools in Alexandria? There are a lot of them.
Yes. I think what the general manager's idea was, we would go with T.C. Williams because the routes that are impacted through T.C. students is fairly limited, but we wanted to see what the utilization is going to be, to see how it overloads the system with people utilizing it, and we don't want to take away from our core ridership. But depending upon the outcome of this academic year, it'll be expanded to possibly middle school as well as the private schools. But yes, it is certainly, we do have quite a few, and it would be very good to provide that option. While they don't do a land office business, for lack of a better expression, the summer pass that's available to the younger population within Alexandria, I believe it's $40, but it takes you through pretty much the end of school, right through September. That seems to be growing, not exponentially, but seems to be growing. But again, we wanted to develop the habits of people taking DASH as their transportation option rather than reverting to any other option. So we're going to see how that goes. But Josh did mention expanding it to other schools as well as tiering it down from the high school at T.C. Williams.
Great.
That's good. Hope it's successful.
Yes.
Yeah, you got to do it one step at a time. Like
exactly.
You try it there and go from there. Okay, no more commission updates, and we'll move on to agenda item number 4, which is the commercial parking standards update.
Katie North, I'm with the Transportation Planning Division. I'm one of the city's parking planners, and you've probably seen some parking-related updates over the last few years that I've been involved with, but this is actually my first time to the Transportation Commission, so I'm happy to meet you all face-to-face. I know that Melissa has been doing a good job giving you all an update on the commercial parking standards study that we've been working on for the last year, but we felt like at this point in time, this would be a good opportunity to bring what the task force has been doing and what they're thinking in terms of recommendation to the commission so we can get your feedback and input on it. So tonight we're looking to give you an update on what we've been doing for the last several months, discuss some of the recommendations and the rationale behind those recommendations, and then we're looking to provide some looking to you to provide some input on what our recommendations are looking like. So that we're all starting from the same point of reference, what I'd like to do is just give you sort of a quick overview of what we're talking about so we all understand what the parking requirement is, how we got here, what the impacts of those parking requirements have been, and then what the goals of our study are. And then Melissa will go over what the task force recommendations are at this point in time. So when we say parking requirement or parking standard, what we're talking about is an off-street requirement that the zoning ordinance sets for specific uses that says a specific use has to provide X number of spaces. And that's usually based on however big that building is or how many seats the restaurant is or how many students go to that use. The parking requirement may not be the same thing as a parking supply. So the parking requirement is what the zoning ordinance says. The parking supply may be different for those different uses. So when we think about changing those parking requirements, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're changing the overall parking that people will be able to have when they go to those uses. In Alexandria, a few examples that we put up there, restaurants, the current ratio is one space per four seats, hotel is one space per each guest room, and then office and retail have spaces that are based off of the overall size of those uses. In 2015, the city updated the parking standards for multifamily. Those standards hadn't been updated since the 60s. So we are currently using those standards now with some of the new development that we see for multifamily. And now we're on to phase two, which is the commercial parking. And that, with that phase, we are looking at office, hotel, retail, and restaurant uses. And similar to the multifamily, this hasn't been comprehensively looked at since the 1960s. So it's definitely time for us to be looking at this. So in thinking about what a parking requirement is, it's important to sort of think about how they even came about in the first place. 1930s, many people were starting to get own cars. They wanted to drive them downtown, but there wasn't any management of those street spaces, and most of those downtowns didn't have off-street lots. So you're finding people just parking all over the curb, parking on the street. There was really no management of those spaces. So two things came out of that. The invention of the parking meter, which we have here in Alexandria, and the invention of off-street parking requirements. So cities started adopting these off-street parking requirements. A lot of times they weren't really based in any sort of fact or any research. It was just, this sounded good. And then you find, well, this jurisdiction did that, so that sounds like it'd work for us, so we're gonna use those standards as well. And in about the 1950s, the city adopted parking standards, and then in 1963, we updated those parking standards. And then that's what we've been using for the last 15 years. So in thinking about what the city's priorities were in the 1960s, car ownership, that was a big thing. Everyone should have a car. Everyone needed a car. The development that we're seeing, we saw that most of that was being developed in a way that it would be easy to get to by a car. Car was the number one thing to accommodate rather than the actual person. And each development that came into play, it had to assume that everyone was going to come there by a car. So the new development needed to provide a space for each of those people that wanted to come. So you see here on the bottom, Landmark Mall, that's a prime example of 1960s development where the best way to get there is by a car. If you are walking, that's going to be quite a challenge. But you can see they provided enough parking so that anyone who wanted to come there could come there by a car. The other thing in the 1960s was there wasn't any metro. The region was starting to think about it at that time, but metro wasn't going to come to Alexandria for a few more decades. So what are the results of these parking requirements? Well, we did achieve the goal of providing a lot of parking, and we constructed a lot of parking. So this is a map of all the parking lots in the city, and it basically is 10% of the city is a parking lot. Now, this doesn't include any of the on-street spaces, which is a substantial amount of parking, and it also doesn't include any of the garages that may be under a roof. So there's a lot of other results that came from those parking standards. Because it was so easy to park anywhere you went, it was easy to drive. So the driving was promoted, which then contributed to the congestion. So more people are driving, more people are on the roads. At the same time, it also undermined the walking, biking, transit modes. If it was so easy to get everywhere you needed to go by a car, why would you bother walking, biking, or using transit? The development that we saw was much more suburban. It had to accommodate the car first, so we see development that's much more spread apart because you need to get the car in there first, and then the person will walk from their car to that front of the business rather than maybe walking from a block away to that business. And then as a result, we've now created a situation where residents now need a car to get around. Even if they didn't want to, they would need a car to be able to get around. This is Potomac Yard, and I would venture to guess that many people who go to the Target at the far end, if they want to go to the other shops on the other end, they're getting in the car and they're driving down there. At the same time, we see a lot of historic buildings getting bulldozed, demolished. We see green spaces paved over to make parking lots because they need to be able to provide for those parking requirements that the zoning ordinance has said we need to have for each of these uses. Development has become more expensive because now, in addition to creating the building, you're also creating the parking lot, which in some cases is twice the size of the actual building. The example on the bottom here is a restaurant, and then what that translates to in terms of the parking requirements. You can see that the parking lot is twice the size of that restaurant. If you're talking about structured parking or underground parking, you're talking about a substantial figure. Spaces today are approximately $30,000 up per space for each of those spaces. So that's a substantial component of each of those developments. And then we also have the stormwater issues from the additional impervious area, the environmental issues from the additional cars that are on the road, and then the health issues of people who are now driving instead of walking or biking when it would be easy to do so. So despite all this, we have these parking requirements that were supposed to solve parking problems, but guess what our number one issue in the city usually is? It's parking. So clearly we have something that's not working the way that we intended it to, and I think that's a large reason for why we are taking a new look at these standards. So has the city changed since 1963? Of course it has. There's definitely more ways to get around. We have Metro now, we have Dash, we have Capital Bike Share, we have Uber, Lyft, we have a whole host of ways to get around for people who don't want to drive, they have those options. We also are seeing new development that is more urban. It's more focused around walkability and mobility rather than focused on allowing a car to be able to get you there quickly and fast. We have a number of city plans and policies that support our urban development and lower parking ratios. Most recently, we have North Potomac Yard and Old Town North that that call for these urban developments and the lower parking ratios and shared parking among uses. But the city was actually doing this as far back as 2003 when we adopted the Eisenhower East Plan. That was the first plan where we actually established a maximum parking ratio as part of those development areas. And then we're still finding that a lot of new developments are still providing too much parking. The example on the bottom is the Harris Teeter in Old Town North. This is a development that had to ask for a parking reduction from the current parking standards. They were approved, and they built the lower parking amount, and now that we've surveyed it, we're finding that the garage is still empty, still about 50% full. So they're providing less parking than they even thought they would need. And then at the same time, we have to be planning for the future. So in terms of transportation, electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles, the Ubers, the Lyfts, those are going to have a huge impact on how people get around. It may be the push that people want to be able to lose one of their cars or both of their cars or any of their cars and have an option to be able to get around without actually owning a car. So we need to be able to plan for that because a car that's not owned may not need to be parked. And then commercial trends. The commercial trends are changing. You can buy almost anything online now from the comfort of your home. So businesses are changing the way that they are selling things or promoting things. You don't have the large department stores that you once did, and you now have a retail restaurant that's more neighborhood-focused, more lifestyle-focused. So in terms of how parking is working today under our current standards, for existing buildings, it's really hard to add new parking to a building that's already built. I mean, you think about adding parking to any of the buildings on King Street, and you just can't do it without taking another building down. What we see is businesses that have these storefronts that we want active, we want to be filled. If they are trying to find parking that's not on their site, it's somewhat of a deterrent for getting those storefronts filled. Now on King Street, we do have the Central Business District, which has some exemptions for parking, but the rest of the city is subject to these parking standards. In terms of business expansion, if a business is doing well, like a restaurant, and they want to add more seats, they have to add more parking. If a yoga studio wants to add more classes and have more students, they have to add more parking because those ratios are based off of the seats and the students. Now, you can provide off-site parking as a way to satisfy some of those zoning requirements, but what we're finding is a lot of the off-site parking is not known or it goes unused, and it's not the parking that people want when they come to those uses. So it becomes something that a business pays for that goes unused. And then for those businesses that can't find off-site parking or don't have that parking on their site, they can go through a special use permit process where they ask for a reduction. And that takes time, that takes money for small businesses. And for a special use permit, that can take upwards of 4 months before they can get an approval. And that's 4 months that a business can't open and start earning money. For new developments, what we're seeing is many developments are coming in asking for parking reductions. That's pretty much every planning commission, city council, you're seeing a development that's asking for a parking reduction. And almost none, they're almost never denied. So we're finding that they're just becoming something that's part of the development package. So why are we updating the ratios? I think we've sort of gone over that, but basically our standards are 50 years old. JFK was our president at the time those standards were in place. So I think it's high time that we have looked at whether those ratios are still applicable. If we want urban development, we have to have standards that support that. We have to have standards that support the walking and the biking and the transit investments and don't make parking such a primary factor of each of those developments. We want to reduce the burden on small businesses. Like I said, time for businesses to have to go through a parking reduction process is time that they are losing earning money. And we also want to just reduce the burden on residents. Residents, owning a car can be expensive too. And if we can provide more ways for people to get around through walking, biking, transit, that's maybe perhaps one less cost on those residents. I mentioned the commercial trends and the changing technology, but those are important factors in why we're updating our ratios. And then the city being an environmental leader. We know that transportation plays a huge role in the greenhouse gas contributions. And anything that we can do to encourage people to not use their car quite as much would go towards furthering the city's efforts to combat climate change. We already have a number of policies and plans in place that support updating these ratios. For this particular group, the comprehensive the Transportation Master Plan has specific policies that call for looking at a comprehensive parking policy that looks at maximums and supports the principles of transit-oriented development. So how are we updating our ratios? Well, we have a task force that's been meeting monthly since March. These are public meetings. And the task force is formed of a variety of people, from residents to commission members to developers. So we have a wide range of expertise on this task force. The task force has been reviewing with us the best practices that we've collected, some of the data that we've collected as well. As part of the study, we did a survey of 60 sites within the city of Alexandria to determine what their actual parking demand was at the peak periods of times, and I'll go through some of those results real quick in just a minute. But using that data and using some of the best practices, the task force has been able to weigh in on some of the recommendations that that have been proposed for each of these uses and come to some decisions, and that's what we'll be talking about in a little bit. So in terms of our overall study, what are some of the assumptions that we are keeping in mind as we come up with these recommendations? We know that people will still drive. We're not naive enough to think that people are just going to drop their cars and everybody's going to walk, bike, take the bus. And we know that we need to be able to provide the parking for those people who do still want to drive. But I think we also need to realize that things are changing, travel patterns are changing. So if there are people who might be inclined to drive a little bit less, I think that seems to be the travel patterns of where we're going. Alexandria is not Manhattan. We know that we're not going to instantly change everyone to New Yorkers and have them only take taxis or take the bus or take the subway. But we are moving towards urban development, and we are seeing a lot of new development come in where people are walking, they're biking, they're coming to Alexandria because they want that type of development. At the same time, when we're doing these ratios, we have to be sensitive to spillover impacts, because we do have this historic city, the historic street grid, and the types of houses that rely on the on-street parking. So being sensitive to how these ratios and what the recommendations are impact those existing areas that rely on that street parking. And it may be requiring a different on-street management rather than throwing more parking to a building. So some of the goals, we want to be consistent, obviously, with our city policies and plans. Specifically, there's the strategic plan that calls for increasing non-SOV trips. And then we also want to support all the investments the city's made in the transit. We want to promote and encourage small businesses. We want to attract quality development and investment in the city. We want to improve the quality of life for residents. And we also want to have simple yet flexible ratios that respond to the market trends that we're seeing. So I mentioned the data that we collected at the 60 sites. These are 60 sites throughout the city. We did not include King Street as some of the study sites, because the parking situation, the parking requirements on King Street are a bit different, and the way that people get to King Street is so different from somewhat different from other sites. So just keep that in mind as I go through some of these numbers. For the 60 sites, every one of those sites except for one had a lower parking demand at that peak time than what the zoning ordinance required. So every site was parked at less than what we're telling people they need to be parked at. And the one site that was parked higher was the McDonald's on North Henry Street. So that's somewhat of a different model from what we're seeing in terms of new development. For the sites, we found that on average there's about 59% occupancy. So basically 40% of the spaces were empty. And that's at the peak time for each of those uses. We did some travel surveys where we interviewed people coming and going to the site to see how they were getting there. And for hotels, we found that a lot of people are coming via taxis, Uber, and Lyft. So people aren't choosing to drive to the hotel and park in the hotel garage. A lot of people are choosing to use these different types of options. Also, for the restaurant-oriented trips, 52% of the people coming to a restaurant for the sites that we surveyed didn't require parking. They were walking. That was probably the largest chunk. People were walking to the restaurants, but there were also people biking, taking transit, or using Uber, Lyft, those kind of ways. And then in terms of parking reductions, we have not denied any of the parking reductions in the last 5 years. So this seems to be something that we have been supporting over the years and recognized that the parking ratios perhaps aren't quite what they should be at this point in time. And then for some of the sites, we did find that they're leasing the spaces because they have these spaces that are just going unused and they need to find some way to utilize that excess parking. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Melissa so she can go over what the task force is thinking in terms of recommendations.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hi.
All right. So this is the exciting part where you get to tell us we're wrong and we should change our recommendations or whatever. All right. So our recommendations, I want to do a quick little recap of our scope of work. So the task force is looking at hotel parking, office parking, retail and restaurant parking, but we also have lumped into retail a whole suite of other commercial uses that are, I believe, by zoning standards, non-retail. It would generally be classified as non-retail. And so there's actually a very long list of uses that we are trying to, in the vein of simplification, give sort of one retail slash non-retail commercial treatment. One of the first tools we looked at in order to structure our decision making around what would be the right ratios and the right treatment for a given project or a given proposal was where these places are in Alexandria and where they are with respect to other transportation options. So this map is an old map that almost nobody is familiar with in this city, residents or professionals, but it's the way that the city is broken out today in terms of parking ratio zones. This is not the zones that we think of when you think of residential parking permit zones, but it's the current structure. And you can see there are a lot of them. There are six different ones. They're kind of spread out. You can tell they have some relationship to transportation options, but it's a little complicated, and we kind of stepped back from this information while using some of the underlying facts in order to develop a newer map. So our newer map is in some ways a simplification. I'm not going to probably in this presentation get into a lot of detail about the assumptions that go into it, but please ask me questions as I go if you want to know how we built this. But it is buffers of half mile from metro stations and proposed BRT, so enhanced transit area overall. The blue is enhanced transit area, but anticipated metro station entryways, which you can see up there in the top corner of Potomac Yard. Those don't exist yet, but they will. Anticipated West End transitway stations, anticipated metroway stations where they don't exist yet, existing metroway stations, and the existing King Street trolley stations. So it was buffers around those enhanced transit area facilities that formed the primary structure of our recommendations. We're sort of dividing up our ratios into two buckets, near enhanced transit and not quite near enhanced transit. We did make some minor modifications, so if you dug into the nitty-gritty here, we looked in closely at three specific areas that would technically fall outside that buffer. We looked at some places along Mount Vernon Avenue because it's a special kind of pedestrian-oriented corridor with a lot of these commercial uses in it. We looked at parts of Old Town North, which has recently gone through a planning process, and we have sort of longer-term objectives for both walkability and future transit that aren't really laid out today. And we also looked at a little piece of South Old Town that has, again, a bit of these commercial uses and use nature that would be appropriate for these ratios to address as with regard to how we think people get to those locations. So what we essentially did in those three places was add some block pieces to the enhanced transit area that might not have otherwise been there if we used a strict buffer approach. Did I cover that? So that's the map. So when I talk further about our recommendations, it's really white areas or blue areas. Okay, and this is the big picture summary, and I'll go into some detail about, let me just see what we've got. Sorry, I didn't get the, okay, yeah. I'll probably flip back to this slide a couple times, but this is a big picture summary, again, by use type, and retail covers, again, other non-retail commercial uses. And within the enhanced transit area, which is the blue, and beyond the enhanced transit area. And I'm going to come back to this later to talk about those numbers. So when we looked at office, a big part of what we did to come up with our recommendations is look at data. Staff did a really good job of bringing us data about how things are being used today. And so we got to look at a bunch of neighboring city kind of data, how they're setting up their ratios. But we also looked at a lot of Alexandria specific things. Our existing zoning, our existing small area plans, what they would require, recent approvals that have come through or gone through, observed, proposed within, and this is our proposed within the enhanced transit area, and that's our proposed outside the enhanced transit area. So you can see observed versus proposed, and we're using a structure similar to the residential parking standards that are in place now, which is that there's, well, I guess it's a little bit different, but there's a min and a max. So projects can come in that range, and we don't have to worry about it. If they want to be above that range, they have to ask for special exception, and if they want to be below that range, they would have to ask for special exception. So the office recommendations today, again, based on data that we looked at and our understanding of peer cities and the experience here so far, is that within the enhanced transit area, we would be doing 0.25 spaces per 1,000 square feet, right? So it doesn't say 1,000 in here. It's per 1,000 square feet for office, up to 1.5 parking spaces per 1,000 square feet. So that's in the blue area for office. And beyond, it would go up to 0.75 per 1,000 square feet, up to 2.25 per 1,000 square feet. For hotel, again, we're looking at recent observations. So these are the recent approvals. Nothing's been more than 0.7. The hotels keep coming in asking for parking reductions. And what we're seeing in observed occupancy for our hotels is, by and large, especially for the newer ones, really low. I believe, can you give me a little reminder of the background for the higher end?
Sure, that 1.1 was the Courtyard Marriott off of 395,
okay.
And also the Sheraton, which we know is also leasing spaces to residents or office users as
okay.
well. So that 1.1 is
yeah.
is other uses
yeah.
in addition. But the average ratio we found was this line here, was the 0.5.
Okay. So this is observed average. And so while I think big picture, we want to give buildings that have overparked many more opportunities to maximize the use of the parking they have built. We also don't want to necessarily force buildings to build more parking than they need in the future so that they have to go find some ad hoc way to make that parking useful to themselves and to others. So the hotel ratios that we looked at within that enhanced transit area, 0.2 to 0.4 in that range, and beyond the enhanced transit area, 0.25 to 0.7. Another thing I want to note, which was a topic of discussion last night at our most recent meeting, is that with hotels, there is this consideration that hotels that have a major conference or meeting function may act differently than hotels that do not. And we talked a lot about hotel experience in different parts of Alexandria today. And the long and the short of it is we didn't come to a concrete recommendation yet, and it'll be a major topic of our next meeting next month, on how to handle meeting space. What we could generally agree on is we think that there's a reasonable threshold somewhere where a building has enough meeting space that it will start to have to host major functions that could change the nature of its parking demand, but we don't know exactly what that threshold is or what we should then do to address that. One of the things that we discussed was actually if we could set a threshold, asking them to provide a study with more information basically on the anticipated demand for parking at the site so that the staff and decision makers could essentially help tailor that particular hotel's parking more appropriately. So that's an open-ended question, and I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on that in discussion shortly. For retail, and again, I guess I'm not going to go through all the details, but we looked at data like this every time. We actually have some really big spreadsheets with a lot of the building-by-building detailed information. We have a list here, actually. I want to mention that in this retail use list for your insight, we've got everything from retail shopping establishment, convenience store, theaters, auditoriums, and assembly halls, medical office, amusement enterprise, daycare centers, private commercial schools, lots of personal services, arts and crafts, bicycle repair, barbershops, dressmakers, laundromats, locksmiths, tattoo parlors, watch repair, so the long list of personal services you could possibly think of, auto repair, animal care facility, animal shelter, health and athletic club, massage, social service, vets. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about retail here. It's a little different. And one of the things we did last night was we actually pulled restaurant out of retail, or recommended pulling it out of retail. Did we write that up here? Oh, yes, we did. Great. Excellent. So for most of our conversations thus far, we've grouped the two together. But the task force last night really felt strongly that restaurants are a little different, both in how important they are to the community, how much we want them to pop up in neighborhoods, but also because of that and because of how they're used, their potential to maybe have a little more parking demand, or if they fill in spots all next to each other in a place that didn't have a lot of restaurant use before, that it may cause unexpected cumulative parking effects. So what our recommendation was to pull it out of the retail and other commercial, give it its own piece here. And the main difference was that we made the mins for restaurant one space per 1,000 square feet, and So the mins are what we changed. We didn't change the maxes. So the max for retail and restaurant are the same, 3 per 1,000 square feet and 4 beyond the enhanced transit area. But the min we bumped up a little bit, so restaurant doesn't come in as low potentially as these other kinds of retail uses.
Can you change from seats to square feet?
Yes, thank you for that. And in the interest of the simplification idea, we also changed from calculating parking for restaurants from seats to square feet so it's consistent across these other uses. We're just trying to make things easier for everybody. And we don't, yeah, having it be seats is confusing. And so again, what do we got for retail? So I wanted to make a little reminder of something that Katie mentioned in one of her slides about the existing conditions. One of the really fantastic, surprising facts in their surveying of restaurants, again, out restaurant retail outside of the King Street corridor, was how many people are going to these uses without a car. It was, what was it again? 52%. So it's not King Street. And I feel like a lot of people see a big difference between King Street and even Old Town compared to the rest of Alexandria. But our sample spread all across Alexandria, and that average 52% across all those parts of town really hit home, that even now there are a lot of people who aren't driving to go out to eat. And we want to support that. So our ratios are proposed to essentially really mirror what we're seeing in real life today, but also not overpark. And a lot of this is couched in terms of the fact that providing parking also incentivizes driving. So we want to keep aiming toward not providing more parking than we need. And here's just showing those restaurant comparisons as well. Okay, so this is the last couple things. Okay, so we had also a big conversation about exemptions and things that are like exemptions, which I'd love to hear more about, feedback from you about tonight. One of the things we talked about was that when uses go into existing buildings and they change use, but not by a lot, they today may have to come before special exception hearings in order to get approval for a parking reduction, because that building, that parcel, doesn't have any parking, but the new use requires one or two spaces, and they can't provide those one or two spaces. So there's a laundry list of approvals and projects that we see all year, every year, as a result of these little use changes, and it's one of those hurdles we're trying to reduce, those barriers to new business startups. So one of the proposals that we are pushing forward today is that new retail or office uses in existing buildings post when we get this approved, just use the parking that's at the building. So it's just that there are certain uses that can be interchanged back and forth over the life of that building, and it doesn't need to provide new parking in order for that to happen. So the uses that we looked at in that were the retail to retail and restaurant to retail. Mm-hmm. There were some uses that we still left question marks on and held back. So a residential building that turns into a restaurant was not something we felt fully comfortable saying it didn't need to have a parking provision change, because a resident, let's say a home that has a two-car family, might have a different parking demand than that home turning into a restaurant, that townhouse or row house in an older part of town turning into a restaurant. So there were some pieces there we couldn't fully flesh out, but this idea of grandfathering existing buildings and their existing parking supply is intended to reduce barriers to small business change and inception in the community in buildings that might otherwise be underutilized. So that brings us to some of these key issues still under discussion. We haven't yet really tackled shared parking, although it's come up several times as a tool that we think is going to help us troubleshoot some of the tricky parts of the proposals that we have thus far. Parking requirements for hotel meeting space I went through with you, and the idea of exempting new small uses, so a new project that's under 5,000 square feet, under 2,500 square feet, under 10,000 square feet, whether there's some size threshold for a new project that might not need a parking requirement, or wouldn't, in particularly for retail and office uses, maybe we don't want to apply the minimums to those small new projects. We haven't quite finished fleshing that out, so I also would be interested in your input on those. And I think those are all of those outstanding. Let me just double check my list. Yeah, those are the outstanding issues. And we just wanted to go over some of the, so I'm going to try to facilitate some discussion here and get some input from you guys on these. I know there's a lot of numbers, and I can flip back to any of the content slides as you need. But one of the things we're trying to do is get a sense from you, how do you feel our recommendations so far are consistent with your understanding of city policies? The city policy structure are overall city objectives, plan objectives that we see come to light through small area plans or come to light through the master transportation plan and things like that. How are these recommendations coming out as far as being consistent with those? How do they look as far as being flexible enough to support new business in Alexandria and in a way that balances the needs of people getting to those businesses, but also the constraints in a dense urban environment? And how are they as far as clarity? Does any of this sound too complicated or something that seems too wishy-washy that we need to tighten up? Those are some of the some guiding questions. We think we're making progress on these, apparently, according to staff. No, it's true.
It's very suggestive.
Right. So in case you were wondering what the answers are.
We just put them in for you.
Those are the big things. And I've got some other questions that I might ask as well. But does anyone have any initial reactions to our recommendations thus far?
Yeah, I can start out, and it took a while to make these changes since the 60s, mm-hmm. and I would hope that in the current recommendations that it's set up to be a little more flexible to change these ratios rather than go through a long process of evaluation. You know, just take the data you have and say, this data shows that less parking is needed or more parking, you know. I think we're looking for less parking, but just to make sure that adjustment, you can make that adjustment without having to go through, you know, a long period of you know, meetings to determine that that's the right way to go. Mm-hmm. So I think that flexibility would make it easier in the future to move in the right direction.
Point taken. I have to admit that thus far our deliberations have not really solved that particular challenge, like the big picture challenge of how frequently and how easy is it to update standards. I would say that the provision in these recommendations of a minimum and a maximum range, and the fact that we're trying to push it close to what we see already every day today without putting an undue constraint on the market on the top when they feel they want to provide more, but also keeping it low on the bottom so that there's some flexibility for a new entrant into the market to not have to come and ask us permission to not provide that parking space or two. That's where we're building in, I think, what we hope is a longer-term applicability of this set of recommendations compared to what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, that certainly would be useful and make it a lot easier to go to the next step, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
Whatever the data shows that it's head in that direction. Others?
Mm-hmm. Melissa, let's take the office as an example. You've got a minimum of a quarter of a space mm-hmm. and a maximum six times as large.
Mm-hmm.
How is the determination made as to whether the particular project is at the low end, the high end, or in the middle?
So the applicant gets to pick. So these ranges are designed to be that a project doesn't need a special approval for anything that falls in that range. So that way, that office building, in anywhere within the enhanced transit area, for instance. So this is the one for proposed within the enhanced transit area. Oh, did I do that? That was me just moving forward. An office building, depending on what its anticipated occupants are. Sometimes a new office building gets built with a known tenant, and if it has a known tenant that it thinks needs a little bit more parking, it may come in with a proposal at the higher end of that range. And if it's an office that is anticipating less need for parking, whether it's because it's a bit closer to Metro than another part of the enhanced transit area, it could come in with a lower parking provision. So we wouldn't actually weigh in on that at all, unless it's staff when they talk with the developers about their projects.
Are you saying, just to give you an extreme example, a medical office building could sell for like a quarter of a space. This is a medical office building filled with individual doctors who have 40, 50 patients a day. They could self-select at a quarter of a space, whereas some other building where the employees come and work all day could have 1.5.
In essence, yes, that is what this is saying. That based on the sample of office buildings that we looked at and where they fell on the spectrum of, we actually have, they're not up here on charts, but scatter plots essentially of where buildings landed in their actual use, the current demand for the parking supply they already have. We feel this range captures the vast majority of demand. So not proposed projects or supplied projects, but the vast majority of demand at a wide range of office types that we see right now. One of my rationales that I would give you for giving them that flexibility is that in the marketplace, the provider of a new building that wants a medical office tenant is probably more likely to be pushing at the top end of that envelope because they're aiming for convenience for their medical office users and their customers. For instance, is that in Arlington, Virginia Hospital Center is looking at plans for how it's going to provide for parking in the long term, and they have a big medical office component to that campus. And
it's kind of
projects like that inevitably are conservative on the side of how much parking that they're providing.
That's kind of a radical Adam Smith break with the way we've been doing things.
and to clarify, we've actually medical offices are very different from standard offices, and so we've placed medical offices under retail.
Well, that raises another question
Thank
in my mind.
That.
Not all retail is created equal either.
That's true.
An antique shop and a hardware store might have very different numbers of flow-through passengers, or I'm sorry, customers.
Right.
Coming and going.
Yep. Yeah, and so, again, we tried to base our ranges on what we've seen in the field, so the data on max peak occupancy at all the buildings that we collected data at in this instance, as well as looking at what other jurisdictions do. Just to bring back to Chris's point, the main difference that you can see, the retail grouping where medical office falls, thanks for that clarification, has a higher max, so that in anticipation of medical office asking for more parking, which is more likely what they would do, we have a higher max of what they could provide without asking for special permission than the traditional office building does, both inside and outside the transit areas.
And like on that, I'm also on the committee of the Driving and Parking Board, and across the board with the uses that we're seeing on the scatter plot with the actual data that staff has collected, there's not a lot of difference between the different types of retail or between the different types of office. Like, because staff had such good data to give us, when we started to talk about this and make these four groupings, we were able to look at them and see, like, well, are there special categories within retail that we need to subsection out? And we really weren't seeing that in the data. There was any real significant difference from one use to the next to the next. Everything was pretty much the same.
The main one that we did talk about last night, and that sort of appeared in the scatter plot was that the restaurants, they didn't go down quite as low in demand as the other kinds of retailers. So that was why we bumped up the minimums, so that that minimum range for restaurants is slightly higher minimum than the rest of retail. And we just took another look, and given what we know about community input on the compatibility of restaurants when they're close to residential areas and other things like that, I mean, this process can't resolve, it's not regulating the street space, so we know that there are other processes Alexandria is going through to tighten up some of those other regulations that will support this, but we did want to acknowledge that restaurants' minimum parking demand is likely to be a bit higher than the rest of retail, so that was why we pulled it out.
My reaction is that if we go to this kind of radical change, I think it would go across better if there was at least some sort of regulatory safety valve at the final end, and it wasn't entirely the applicant's choice, but there would be a certain presumptive validity to the applicant's choice.
Well, anything would need to be approved by planning and zoning and then council, right? Any new development use would have to be approved. So there is that regulatory.
Well, I think one of our objectives here is that there's a certain number of projects that come through and require council approval because they need a parking exception of some sort. Right now, they need a parking reduction because they can't provide the amount that they're required to provide under the current ordinance. And we want to reduce the amount of that as one of the factors, one of the interests in this in producing this. So it's very likely that major developments are going to come through a special exception approval anyway, not because of the parking itself, but because of other things they're asking for. So this won't prevent that. And I guess parking could be considered as part of an approval process like that. But if this were approved, let's say as is, we wouldn't be able to force them to do something outside of the range that we've given them. To your point about, what was the phrase that you used?
Safety valve.
No, I got that phrase.
Radical departure?
No, it wasn't that one either. It was the tacit approval or acceptability.
Oh, the self-determination?
Presumption of validity, thank you. The presumption of validity is what we need to aim for now. So what we want is that the ranges that council approves have the presumption of validity because that range has been tailored to existing data in Alexandria, best practice in the region, best practice outside the region, and our overall policy objectives. So we want to achieve the presumption of validity now, so that as staff is implementing it later and as those projects come in, we are comfortable with them falling anywhere in that range.
But the idea of a presumption is that there's always an outlier somewhere along the line that's going to be trouble, mm-hmm. and we can't let them rest on the final legality of being within the range. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying.
Right. So if there's a weird project, is there any tool that we have available in this context to address the fact that it's weird?
I think that would help sell the project, the whole enterprise.
And how does the max compare to what's on the books now? I mean, I can understand the minimum's much lower to prevent more of these exemptions needed right now, the reduction, but is there any, it might be extreme, but I don't know, it's hard to tell.
It seems really big to me.
The range is quite big, so that's why I was curious.
Like pretty high. This is our current, it's all minimums right now, so the lowest minimum is 1.67, and then the highest minimum is 2.2. So it's, and just to compare that quickly to, this is recent approvals, so this is what the zoning says, minimum you have to provide. This is what has been approved, and very recent approvals. This is not the whole data set that we looked at, and this is the observed in the sample, which runs in this range. So there are some as full as this, but again, they're providing more parking because they had to back when they were built. And they go down as low in observation as this.
Well, I'm not worried about the observation. I'm just curious, what's required is
the minimum amount compared to what our maximum is right now.
Right.
I mean, our proposal for...
So the proposed maxes that you see for office here and here
yeah.
are related to, essentially, the distribution within... This is lumped all together. Yeah. So these two, if you were to average them out, this is in observations within and outside the enhanced transit area. But basically, we looked at that scatter plot, and we created these arms around the top and the upper end and the lower end of the observations. So this is these represent the range of what we're seeing being mm-hmm. offered today.
Right.
And every once in a while, there are ones that are above that. And there are some that are below that.
Like what, for example, for office right now, what's the requirement minimum number of spaces?
So the lowest minimum is 1.67 according to the zoning ordinance.
And it goes back to those six zones that we first showed.
Right, so there's six different office requirements depending on where you are in the city. So our proposal would be for within that enhanced transit area, the maximum you could do would be 1.5. Outside of that would be 2.25, which is somewhat comparable to that upper minimum. So the difference would be now the minimum is the maximum.
Because what I was wondering was, are we going far enough? I mean, if our max too much, if we're trying yes. to reach these, from my perspective, from the environmental things, are we actually going to get to our, if we're just doing what we're observing today and not thinking mm-hmm. about the future and our goals and objectives for, especially for, I'm thinking environmental policies, yes. does it go far enough? You know, the max, if everyone can pick the max without having to question or justify picking the max, right. it doesn't guarantee us moving towards some
most
of our...
Most of them will not have the economic incentive to pick the max.
The max, so it'll be the opposite. Yeah.
That's my segue into, for example, BRAC and building new construction, soliciting federal agencies to come to the city of Alexandria, allowing new construction for the agencies. I'm a federal employee, and I know most families don't choose to live in the city of Alexandria because they want to live in Arlington, Loudoun, or Fairfax because of the schools. So there's an incentive for people to commute into the city and then go back to their homes for federal employees and use Fairfax, Arlington, and Loudoun surrounding school systems. So my incentive is if we allow federal government buildings to maximize parking space, that's going to be counter to discouraging SOV, counter to discouraging transit because people are going to be zipping out to get back to their families. I just keep thinking of BRAC. You know, some of us live right there in the center city, and we have major highways now of cut-through traffic, and much of it is because of BRAC. And so then my further concern, so I was wondering, within the concept of office, are we going to do something about federal and encourage federal employees to be using transit, carpooling, as alternatives to every single one of them coming, you know, in single occupancy vehicles, which I can assure you is happening. And then my further question is limiting parking. In some instances, can it be retroactive? So for example, BRAC, we know what, there's what, 6,500 spaces there? Can
a lot.
There's a lot, yeah. Yes, 6,500 spaces. Presumably it would be enhanced transit environment because they have that bus system there, but I don't know if it is would be or not considered, you know, but is there any way to retroactively limit parking so as to force feed use of transit, which is a part of their initial plan, but it doesn't seem that is occurring as much as this. And so that's just one example. I know the NSA building is, you know, going up, and I know mm-hmm. Alexandria Victory Center, and, you know, Alexandria likes federal buildings
yep.
and federal employees being here, but how do we encourage the use of transit and other than non-SOV? And it seems that putting such high maximums, the federal government, I mean, there's a yeah. big pit of money there, big pot, and they would happily, you know, we have to pay for parking. They'd happily, you know, build parking spots for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
That's good feedback. To my understanding, what we're doing here doesn't help us with retroactively reducing parking at existing sites.
Yep.
However, it may facilitate redevelopment of existing sites, such as, I'm going to give an example. The Victory Center is a weird example, but let's just say that Victory Center has parking lots on a, like all around it, mm-hmm. and under slimmer parking requirements that we're suggesting here compared to what exists historically, they could potentially do more, put more density on the site and not put back as much parking. And that would both make a redevelopment of a site like that more profitable if it turns out that they can parse it out that way because they can put more on it besides just parking. And then there are smaller examples of that as well, where we have one tool, like this is one tool, and other tools that Alexandria could probably do more with are the TDM program and transit system, both expansion and other kinds of incentives to get people on transit. I don't know enough about how specific federal project deals go through to make those developments happen where it's a partnership with the federal government. But the federal government, in theory, on the books, has major objectives for getting people out of cars and reducing pollution and things like that. The problem is when it trickles down to GSA and the implementation of specific land use decisions, it's not always coming to fruition.
So don't we have control from this end on limiting the amount of parking that...
Well, we
for example, federal.
We can't take it away from them.
Yeah, but or at least in the future, that right. just seems it seems like high
yeah,
numbers.
Moving forward,
numbers.
I think that we should encourage
yes.
the reduction in number of spaces and having, in the case of federal employees, having them maximize the use of the federal transit
absolutely.
Benefit, which
exactly.
is available to them.
Well, that's why I'm saying, like especially in office, those mm-hmm. maximum numbers seem awfully high. I mean, they seem high,
right.
and why not build to the max for? You know, all the federal employees that
it's
are coming
option.
From.
Why, yeah, I just said, why not?
Yeah. I mean, sure. so limit it.
Yeah. We should consider alternatives.
Do you happen
yeah.
to know what the utilization is at the National Science Foundation? That's probably the most recent large transfer of a unique population to Alexandria.
So I don't know. We don't have anything since it's been opened.
Oh, okay. I didn't mean to put anybody on the spot, but I mean, that's the largest new implementation of a facility that I think relates to some of the issues that we're talking
when it,
about.
When it was approved, at a ratio of 0.95.
Which is almost one car per employee.
But that was much less than what the maximum was for that plan when it was at the time, because it came in under the Eisenhower East plan, which I think had a maximum of two. So they actively... lower than what they had could have been able to do.
Not per employee. And there's about 4 to 6 employees per 1,000 square feet, generally.
4 to 6 per 1,000.
Melissa, one more thing. I know you said that shared parking is a work in progress, and I think that makes sense because you have to kind of figure out your basics before you figure out how to share. But I just wanted to offer some thoughts on shared parking anyway. I just think it's really important because zoning has evolved from a concept where it was necessary to keep all the residential separate from the retail to where now we value residential over retail. It's one of the most important components of urban life. So it's really important to figure out the right amount of parking in that kind of a context. And I urge you to do a little surveying of where other folks have tried to solve that problem and try to get a sense of how successful they have been, because it's not an easy problem to solve. It's not a simple matter of just thinking of X number of spaces for one use plus XY number of spaces for the other. There are ways to figure out how you can get by with a whole lot less than X plus Y. Which was going to be real good for us if we can do that.
I totally agree with you. And one of the challenges that I experience in the field as a staff person working in building development is that residential uses often also don't like to share. Residential uses like to have discrete, secure parking that's separate from their retail compatriots elsewhere in the building. And that can create operational challenges to a developer or building manager coming in and proposing a true shared parking situation that works operationally. So even if you got the ratios right and did a good calculation and it's the right amount, might butt up against it not operating correctly. And so that would be, I would say, probably end up being follow-up recommendation kind of thing that this group could come out. We might be able to propose a shared parking approach, but then we'd have to ask staff to work on what, if anything, do you do with conditions of development that facilitates that sharing happening in reality. I do know that there is a very widely accepted and sort of complicated, I think it's a ULI shared parking model, which is a difficult calculation that has a whole book to tell you what you're supposed to do, that I'm not super familiar with, but it intends to do what you describe and not just add X plus Y, but it looks at the time of day patterns of each of the uses and gets into the real nitty gritty about how, if you put a certain amount of square feet of each kind of use together, what might you be able to result with.
Any other questions?
I would say, you know, so I hear 10% of the city is parking, so that means, you know, like 5% of that can someday be developed as, you know, further density or affordable housing or parks or something of higher and better use than underutilized parking in strategic areas, of course. And I'd also say I'm reading more and more about how, you know, curb space is increasingly valuable, and that's a scarce resource. And you know, you're saying that the scope of this isn't like the street area, but what if a development said, you know, I'm not utilizing all this parking, but I have, you know, some fraction of 30% mode share for ride share or taxis as you had for hotels currently, and that's probably only going to go up in the future. Could I convert some of this parking space to management areas of the pickup and drop off experience?
And you mean street parking space?
No, within the
building.
Normal parking lot. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, that they would do that as like a, you know, like you have in front of a nightclub with the valet drop-off area or something. Yeah. Is there provision for that? And then, you know, there's a restaurant near where I live in Lynnhaven that has abundant parking, and they converted some parking spaces into basically an outdoor beer garden for a couple of weeks, and, you know, live music and all that, and, you know, I thought that was great. So I think provisioning that sort of flexibility, you know, on a temporary basis or something like that, like, I'm not sure if they got a permit for that or what, but I thought that was kind of a, you know, because otherwise I think they could probably sell off half that parking lot and redevelop it as another retail space or, you know, other business or something.
So would you say, I just want to paraphrase to see how we might move those ideas forward, that in that last case that you were talking about, if there was an existing use that under the new requirements didn't need all the parking that it does have, that it might have, what are our options for making it really easy for them to convert parking to something else?
To something useful.
Right, because now they don't need it.
As you were saying, some people are leasing out spaces, but I think that's just, you know, one of several options that they could use for that space. You know, even if it's like a restaurant and you could have more outdoor seating or, you know, something. Mm-hmm. So, because the worst thing is just a parking space that never goes used. I mean, that has no environmental benefit, has no community benefits. And I definitely, you know, think the shared parking, you know, is definitely the path to go, especially if they're like complementary uses, like a daycare next to a, you know, restaurant with a bar or something like that, has very different like peak periods of usage. So why have abundant parking for both when they could just share? So.
And just thinking on that a bit, I was wondering, it's not really fitting in with the zoning part as much, but in the design of a building, if it's new building, there was some discussion, I think it was one of the last maybe two meetings ago, of having more parking lots, having the certain architectural design that it could be more easily converted into other space if instead of just staying as a lot. And I think that could be considered too, if they're considering the planning, that if you guess wrong, if we got this wrong, and they still are building too much or too little, like it would be good to have that in part of the planning process, that they're considering like it spaces that could be converted into more living space.
We're right for the next 5 years,
yes.
And then after that 5 years period,
what's
we're
the long term?
You know, mm-hmm. That's over parked. So.
Right, right. And I had one more thought about the. I understood what we were saying. Most of them are probably going to pick the max because there's an economic incentive to go less, and so there's a sweet spot that these builders are going to have for wanting to, an incentive for them to reduce their parking. But there becomes a point where it would become more expensive to probably go that extra mile or that extra step of thinking environmentally about it and trying to push, you know, adding the shuttles or adding other transportation options or adding more bike parking, and they might go the easiest route as well, you know, thinking easy as well as economic. And so I don't know what that number would be in there, how we would add in some criteria, but I do like the idea of trying to consider how can we push them to kind of go that extra step and think, you know, future, think the trends and direction that the city's trying to go to meet those objectives. I'm not really sure how it fits with the zoning. I don't know if it would be more like when we start looking at, we'll be updating things in the EPC with the green building policies, and there's, you know, transportation chapters in there that in our environmental action plans. But I'd like to keep that in mind as we're moving forward, that we're considering how can we push them to make those decisions, to add the bike, you know, the bike parking, and maybe remove a few more spots for that reason, even if it's not in their financial interest. If we can somehow squeeze that into the zoning, into this ordinance.
Yeah, and I think that, well, the financial bottom line is the biggest one for them. There are some pressures. There's just inertia. What are they used to doing?
Mm-hmm.
And well, I think developers do a good job of gauging the market. They're not perfect. Sometimes they don't get it right, and they're also risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at some level, they're not going to take a big risk on a zero parked building
right.
in Alexandria today. I mean, mm-hmm. DC's got one or two of those, I think, but they're not likely to come here just yet because they won't think the market can handle that. They also don't have a lot of familiarity with doing some of the other things that mm-hmm. we wish they would do. They are not in the business of providing bike facilities until relatively recently. They're getting better at that now.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't historically been in the business of providing transit, but they could. Mm-hmm. At some level, they could provide or subsidize or otherwise facilitate transit in a much more proactive way.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have business models to even model after. So
mm-hmm.
some of that, I think, is going to be us doing our best to help give them the tools
mm-hmm.
so that they could look at it as a serious amenity and resource for their potential tenants that could even differentiate them in the marketplace. And then they won't be running away. They'll be banging down our door for help making it happen.
As Carolyn mentioned, I think it's important to also take into account, although it's a small piece, is to provide bike parking, and also along with that is facilities for bike share in the commercial one, you know, when they put them in. I think they do that, but it should be somewhere in there in writing that a lot of a certain size should allot somebody spaces for bike parking, because bike share would
okay.
be outside.
So that's interesting. We are looking at car parking ratios. Can staff give me like a refresher on Alexandria's bicycle parking standards of development? Is there a standard ratio?
So we do have standards based on the different uses and the size of those uses. Right now they're standards, and that's what we apply to each of the developments coming forward and say to determine it. It's not an actual zoning requirement, but thus far we have told developers this is your requirement. And that's
okay.
been the case. We put it in as a condition.
And do those exist for all the uses we're looking at right now?
I believe so. I will have to go back and double check, but I think it hits most of these ones we've recently come across in the churches and schools where we don't have a specific standard, but I think it covers all these. Check.
Great. Bike share, I would argue, is a little. I'm happy.
Well,
it's in my notes. It's a little more complicated because.
Well, that's always outside, so that.
Well, it's it's more complicated because it has operational expenses. So even if you got them to build it, we'd have to run it. So we have to have a way to ensure that the city can manage that over time. And there are ways, but those become more complicated than a ratio. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a different, a little different animal there.
Yeah. We do have sort of like an internal staff policy for when we would ask a development of a certain size to contribute towards either adding a station or contribute towards a station in the area. So we do have some parameters, but it's like the bike parking is not in the zoning ordinance. It gives us a little more flexibility.
Anybody else have any comments?
I have one more question for you all before we move on to another topic. And so you saw a presentation. This is the first of the sort of commission and interest stakeholder group presentations that staff and the task force are doing to share our recommendations and to share the premises upon which we are doing this work. And I was wondering if you had any feedback for us on what we offered here. So the types of material that Katie went over in her introductory slides, the ways that we presented our recommendation material on the back end, both in the slides and in our what we hit on in our presentations. Because if you have feedback on that, things that you felt were extraneous, stuff you thought was really important and you were glad we included, things you thought were missing, that you were hoping we would talk about, anything like that would help us because we have some time now to tighten it up as it goes before. This virtually the same presentation will go before many different audiences, and we want to make sure that we're making it as effective and productive as it can be.
Well, I have to commend it. To me, the whole basis was based on the accurate data that you had to start with, and you worked with that data to come up with, you know, the ratios, which is, you know, that's the way it goes. And the way you presented it is, you know, there's a lot of data there, a lot of numbers, but it looked pretty clear to me. And, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I would echo that. Being that it's data-driven, it would take any emotion out as you start to go in front of different stakeholders and other groups that may have a particular passion for it heading in a given direction. The fact that this is all based on the current utilization, which is the here and now, I think was very, very helpful and establishes a fine starting point. So I commend you and the staff for that, you know, that approach. I found it very helpful.
I think those numbers are per 1,000 square feet, aren't they?
Correct. Yes. Yeah, that needs to be
probably
written.
Want to add that.
Yeah.
Oh, the presentation's very good.
Yeah, I would like to see a breakdown of your test sites, the sites where you did
like
your analysis.
A list of
the actual sites.
Mm-hmm. If we have a map, we can include that.
Yep. Yeah, I think that would be interesting.
Great. Sure.
Chair,
Jim, do you want to add a comment?
Okay, can I give a comment? Building on the comments just made, the presumption of validity comes from the fact that this is built on data. Sitting here, probably not more than 12 feet away, I couldn't see the data.
Right. Yeah.
So you really need, in my opinion, a handout, a one-page handout that people can actually stare at the data. And I would also try to provide it as a read-ahead, but as Jared talked about in general earlier, but so much depends. You know, the skeptics are going to go, well, I don't believe that. They're going to say, show me the data. I can't read those slides in the back of the room. Yeah. Or they're going to say, show me the sites.
Right.
So a combination of your comments, one way to address that is maybe some data handouts for the people that want the data. They're not going to believe this. Just a thought. The presentation itself is. Again, if the data slides could be more readable from a distance, that would help. But I think the handout's the real solution.
Yeah, that does help. Any other comments? Katie, Melissa, I want to commend you on an excellent presentation. And there was a lot to soak up, but I think you're headed in the right direction.
Yeah. So in terms of next step, this won't be the first and last time you guys see this. We are, like Melissa said, taking this out to the different stakeholder groups. The task force still has some work to do. Planning Commission will be looking at this in October, as well as the council. And then it'll come back to the Transportation Commission as a public hearing item for you all to sort of make a formal recommendation.
Okay.
You will be seeing us again.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, next agenda item number 5 is a Vision Zero Action Plan Framework. This is sort of the draft of the action plan.
I'll just sit over here. Hi everyone. Unfortunately, Ray got sick this afternoon, and so he couldn't make it tonight. So I'm presenting for him. So I apologize for that in advance. But we wanted to present the Vision Zero Action Plan Framework. This isn't, you know, similar to the parking standards. This isn't the last time you'll see this. So we wanted to give you kind of a heads up before the first draft is released to the general public, you know, for comments and just to kind of make you aware of what we've been up to in a little more detail. So can you all read this? I didn't realize how small this would be.
we older folks.
You can summarize the highlights for us.
Sure, no problem. So just to give you a little bit of the background, you know, the Bicycle Master Plan was adopted in spring of 2016. One of the recommendations was to develop a Vision Zero plan. In the summer and fall of 2016, we drafted a resolution that in January was supported and adopted by City Council. And the resolution was to create a Vision Zero Action Plan. So that's what we're doing. And the goal was to, as the name suggests, zero traffic deaths and serious injuries by 2028. So I know you're all somewhat familiar with Vision Zero, but just so we're kind of starting from the same spot. It's a multinational traffic safety project to achieve zero traffic deaths or serious injuries. So this is a multinational kind of movement. It started in Sweden back in 1997, and then started with New York City. So dozens of cities around the country have adopted this Vision Zero as well. It's multidisciplinary, or it's multi-departmental, so it's not just tests, but you know, we're working with the police department, schools, our Office of Performance and Accountability to look at data, and so it's really a kind of a holistic, comprehensive look at how to eliminate traffic deaths and serious injuries. So the action plan timeline. So we formed in February. It was actually my first day at work. It was the first interdepartmental meeting where we involved several other departments, for example, schools, police, etc. We reviewed existing programs and policies. In May, we started our extensive community outreach program, which I'll go into more detail in another slide. We completed a comprehensive crash analysis, which I'll also go into more detail. We identified data-driven best practices, and so here we are. We're finalizing the draft action plan for review. And after this, there will be a Transportation Commission hearing in December or January on the final plan, and then a council hearing to adopt the action plan. So an overview of the public involvement so far. The goals were to increase awareness of Vision Zero, that the city has this goal at all, this policy at all, and to teach people what that means, and also to gather feedback on the public's perceptions of what's dangerous, because you know we can look at data all day long of crashes or reported crashes, but then you know, there's also the unreported crashes, and then more importantly, the near misses, where you know, they're not necessarily dangerous intersections, but they feel very dangerous, and so and they could, in the future, lead to crashes. So our approach, you know, as we mentioned in previous meetings, was we decided in order to maximize the amount of input that we got from citizens, from residents, we decided to forego kind of the typical night meeting approach that, you know, you might get 20, 30 people there, it costs a lot of money, takes up a lot of time. And so we instead did pop-up events around the city. So we had five different events where we had several different iPads with a survey and a wiki map so people could fill out the survey, answer their questions, and then point to areas that they felt were dangerous that they were familiar with. And so this is, again, this is all around the city. One was at the Old Town Farmers Market. Another one was in Arlandria. Another at the Mark Center. Another on the west side, and there's one at the Braddock Road Metro Station as well, just to kind of get very different. TC Williams as well. The outcome was that we talked to 467 people in person, and then we had another over 500 more additional people fill out the survey online. So close to 1,000 respondents. The key findings, so the top three, what people identified as the top three challenges to move around safely in Alexandria are distracted driving, which we actually have absolutely no data on because it's hard to collect and it's somewhat new, I guess, for police to even assess. But distracted driving, speeding, and then people running red lights or stop signs. Those are dangerous behaviors, obviously. It's no question about it. And over 60% of participants actually experienced or knew someone who was involved in a traffic fatality or serious injury. And no coincidence, I'm sure, is the primary factors reported were distracted driving, speeding, and people running red lights and stop signs. So. And here's the wiki map that we also had people fill out to show kind of dangerous activities and dangerous geographic areas. The key findings were speeding, drivers failing to yield, and then poor accessibility due to sidewalk or other infrastructure conditions, and then confusing traffic patterns. Then we had we looked at crash data, had a crash data analysis of APD data from 2011 to 2016. The methodology was descriptive exploration. I don't remember what that means from my intro to statistics class, but I think it's very good. As well as a statistical analysis with significance tests and logit models. There were several limitations with the data, the quality of the data, the geographic. We actually had to go into just about every specific data and geocode it manually. A good thing about Alexandria is that there isn't a high volume of KSI crashes. So that's a good thing, but it makes it hard to also run data on it. So I'm not gonna go through these, but there were 10 main findings. Some of the main findings were not very surprising. For example, there were specific corridors with elevated risks. Environmental conditions like weather or lighting led to KSI risks. Speed increased KSI risks. These are things that we've found kind of nationwide and worldwide lead to fatalities or serious injuries or higher rates of fatalities and serious injuries. But one interesting, specifically Alexandria point, is that KSI crashes have been dropping since 2011, which is good. And, it might be in part due to the vigilance of organizations like the Transportation Commission, who are very interested in pedestrian and bicycle and traffic safety. So here's some graphs of the total crashes. Now there was, since, I did say that they've been dropping ever since 2011. However, in 2016, there was an uptick in crashes, total crashes, and we don't really know why. These are pedestrian only, or pedestrian crashes, bicycle crashes, and then vehicle only crashes. Again, speed matters. 100% of pedestrians that were involved in a crash where the vehicle was going 40 miles an hour or more had a serious injury or did not survive, as opposed to 18% of pedestrians who were involved in a crash of 20 to 29 miles.
So this is our local data?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't wait. You went so too fast. I'm looking at your picture.
Yeah, and you know, this also mirrors national trends of and simple physics of, you know, the faster a car hits a pedestrian, the more likely they are.
Can you remind us what your N is total for the KSIs that are in this sample?
No, I can't.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay. No worries.
All right. So from 2011 to 2016, 445 pedestrians were involved in crashes, and one out of seven of those led to a KSI, a fatality or serious injury. Kind of pointing out that pedestrians are much more vulnerable than other road users, which is also very intuitive. So the action plan organization going forward, intends to answer five major questions. So why is Vision Zero needed? how is the action plan developed? How will we achieve Vision Zero? And what will it take to achieve Vision Zero? And how will we measure success so that this can be data driven and actually, you know, we can evaluate it year after year to figure out what's working and what's not. So we developed several different strategies based on the KSI data analysis findings, public involvement, existing programs, policies, and plans, input from the work group, data-driven best practices, and then just general key principles that we know work. So there's four strategy themes, and this probably isn't very surprising to folks who are kind of plugged into these things. Engineering, education and enforcement, administrative and policy strategies, and then evaluation strategies. So this kind of gets at the core of them. And then underneath each one, there's dozens of different specific recommendations, which we're still kind of hashing out. So again, the next steps, finalizing the draft for comment period next month. We'll open up the comment period, it's about 2 or 3 weeks, to the general public. We'll also come back to the Transportation Commission, before while we're still in the public comment period, so that you guys have some time to digest, the plan and everything and provide comments.
So probably the November meeting?
Actually, December. Well,
during the comment period?
During the comment period, yes. Yeah, probably November, yeah. And then December, we'll come back for a final public hearing for the action plan and hopefully endorsement, and then go to City Council in December or January.
So of the 445 pedestrian incidents, KSIs?
Mm-hmm. Those are crashes.
Or crashes.
Yeah, and then one out of seven of those are resulted in a crash.
I assume there's like a police report associated with each of those and,
yes.
And a potentially a location with at least like cross streets or address or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a map of where those hot spots are potentially throughout the city?
There should be, yeah, and that should appear in the report.
I would wonder how that lines up with the wiki map, as specifically people have identified this as a dangerous mm-hmm. pedestrian crossing.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah, that's a great question.
And maybe of those four strategies, maybe it's like different contexts. Like this one needs better education, this one needs more engineering, and mm-hmm. Maybe some as a blend of multiple strategies. So.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, could you make sure that this gets posted on the website,
mm-hmm.
this one and the one before that Melissa.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Had on
the
commercial part.
Yeah, presentation will be.
And along that, as far as your strategy development, I think one of the items you ought to have in there is the budget, because you can have all these plans and what you're going to do, but if you don't have a budget to actually carry it out, it's just going to get behind the power curve and you're not going to make any progress. So I think that that should be, you know, an essential part of the strategy is to have the funding to achieve these goals.
Absolutely.
You got 10 years if you...
Mm-hmm. Separate from complete streets.
That's right.
Complete streets.
And, you know, the thing with budget is, I mean, you can't spend an unlimited amount of money, but at the same time, like, the cost of one, you know, pedestrian incident is mm-hmm. massive. Like, that's the equal to the cost of, you know, upgrading a pedestrian crossing with, you know, the whole gamut of technologies. Mm-hmm. So
it would, building on that then, a recommendation would be, it would be great to see in the plan some reference to that. Secondary sources, obviously we don't expect you to do a value of a statistical life calculation, but I'm sure there's other folks' research that would show what you give up when you let people get seriously injured or killed in crashes. And you can, I think it's almost too simplistic to even just put a dollar value on it. There should be a dollar value as one of the elements of describing it, but also those other intangible yet intangible, unquantifiable aspects of what happens to a community when people are hurt this way.
Yeah, the cost of society and the cost of the victims, and mm-hmm. you know that is a value there.
Yeah, I mean the medical expenses alone, but like for the Safe Route to School program, one thing that I hear that sells that a lot is, you know, the lifestyle factors is if you can ingrain in kids this culture of like walking places versus being driven in a bus, you're saving money on the bus, but you're also, you know, potentially saving, you know, healthcare costs as well by having a healthier lifestyle. So.
There's actually very good calculations that the, you know, UN research, the World Bank has done in terms of useful years of life lost. So that's how they do it. They don't want to put a value, a dollar value on a life, but they can put a value on how much productivity that person has lost.
So. Yeah, another question on the data.
Sure.
I don't know if you know this, but could that be posted so the public can look at the data that the Vision Zero is based on? Because that's the baseline is where you start, and then each year you measure to see if you're making any progress. And I think that data should be available to the public mm-hmm. through, you know,
yeah. I mean, like
your
Sweden?
Website.
Like,
yeah, I mean,
Sweden,
one of the items, one of the recommendations in here is to, and I think maybe the Office of Performance and Accountability has already started, but to create a Vision Zero dashboard.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, that data should be available to the public.
Absolutely.
Could you go back one slide, I think? And I know I mentioned this before, but on the education and promoting a culture of safety, mm-hmm. I know that there's a lot of focused on teaching pedestrians and bicyclists to be safe, but I think the big thing is teaching motorists to because they're the person who is operating the vehicle most likely to cause the most amount of damage to someone else. And, you know, I think that means maybe partnering with the driving schools in Alexandria, also the driver's ed program at the schools, and kind of expanding beyond that. I know, you know, I just went to the city hall and paid my taxes for my car. That would have been a great opportunity to get an update on, hey, just a reminder, keep an eye out for bicyclists, keep an eye out for pedestrians. People come in every year to pay that tax. So I think where people are engaging with city government, especially around their vehicle, is a good opportunity for us just to remind people to, you know, even if it's just the, hey, you know, remember this, mm-hmm. that helps.
Oh, that's a good idea, yeah. Yeah, we're also thinking like maybe speeding tickets, like on the back of every like speeding ticket or parking citation or something.
Well, the bottom line of Vision Zero is a change in culture. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen overnight. I mean, it's more than just education. It's have to change your mindset, and that's what's, you know, these countries have been doing this for 20 years have found out that mm-hmm. once you change the culture, then you see a change in the actual data
yeah.
that you're making progress. So that's a hard thing to do. But
I have a question, a follow-up question for staff related to that. As you're working, you have like an interdepartmental group that's working on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
For something, for strategy theme one, build safe streets for everyone, and how that's an engineering piece, and you're gonna have all these, I'm sure you'll have proposed action steps. On the one hand, that's engineering, like an action step could be build X number of this kind of new facility in these kinds of places. But to Jerry's point, what has been your sense in working with staff across different departments and groups on the perspective, culture, awareness sort of angle on the importance of achieving engineering solutions? On do staff have the tools and the knowledge that are needed to make the solutions happen that are going to be necessary to success? Is that itself an area where we need to invest more, or is everyone aware you don't have the priorities in place to get that to use the staff abilities and skills that you've already got?
You mean staff in other departments or staff,
all across? So in other departments, but also in transportation in particular. I mean, sometimes even between the building and the engineering of improvements, you're still mm-hmm. working across several groups. It's not necessarily just one mm-hmm. small team.
I think it's been mostly the assumption that Tess would kind of handle most of the engineering aspects of it. Mm-hmm. Probably educate, say, like public, the school folks along the way while we're doing it. It also kind of overlaps pretty well with like Safe Routes to School, for example.
And so Tess is good. Like you feel like the exposure to these concepts is it's old hat for the staff that you've got, and that there isn't any need for almost like I don't know.
Like trainings or something.
Doing additional capacity too is an option. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
Like, right. Like is there something where there's an action step that actually needs to be dedicate training resources to staff to make sure we stay up to date on the latest and greatest knowledge about these engineering solutions? Because if you sit three engineers at a table, they'll have three different ways of solving a problem potentially.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure that they're using the solutions that are prioritizing pedestrians' safety, ultimately.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, our our Complete Streets program, we have that expertise, definitely. I mean, we also created the Complete Streets guidelines for the city, too. We can always learn more. We do have a kind of a conference budget that I think is not specifically focused on Vision Zero, but just in general professional development budget for employees. And that's one of our priorities is to kind of stay up to date with what's going on. But yeah.
On the capacity piece to it and sort of money and budgets, I know, at least I think the recommendation we put forward was like an 18-month lead line on sidewalk repairs, because there's just not the money in the budget. Mm-hmm. Is there sort of an aspect of this that will, and budgets are always special documents and sort of anything, but I know that there was a huge issue getting some crosswalks in the West End repainted, mm-hmm. and we were finally able to do it because we like called Hillary and she was like, oh, we actually have people that like sometimes don't have like additional work on like a Friday afternoon, and it got taken care of in like a week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I think that where we can find those opportunities to get things moving through the process, and it doesn't involve multiple citizens calling someone on the transportation commissioners, calling someone on the traffic and parking board to get things done, like.
Mm-hmm.
The repainting a sidewalk is a very simple investment that's going to enhance safety pretty significantly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, and I know one of the crosswalks was the one on Duke Street right by the McDonald's, which had a KSI.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess sort of on the capacity front, like, are there ways where we can work more efficiently and effectively? And, maybe that is, the answer isn't always hiring someone to coordinate that, but mm-hmm. is there a way where there's, capacities or efficiencies that can be met across departments and intra-department so that, a crosswalk it doesn't take a year and a half to get one repainted. It doesn't take 18 months to get a sidewalk repaired.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Just kind of looking at internal systems and measuring efficiency, or finding efficiency.
Could, when you're done making that note.
I write really slowly.
Okay. I'd rather you write it than try to remember it later. could you go back another slide or two? There was a slide that I'll recognize when I see it. That one. Okay, so the action plan is going to try to tackle these big picture topics, and then your actions are sorted in those other categories we saw later. Okay. Mm-hmm. So why is Vision Zero needed? How is the action plan developed? Okay, so one of my questions was, number three is how will we achieve Vision Zero? Mm-hmm. And then number four is what will it take to achieve Vision Zero? Can you tell me a little bit more about how those are different for you guys? How you envision them being different in terms of the content in the document?
Honestly, I can't give you a great answer.
Diplomatically put.
I can't give you a great answer, but I would assume that how we will achieve Vision Zero is more kind of, you know, how, like maybe, might be more of a chronological, like how are we going to get to zero KSIs? You know, maybe interim goals of maybe by 2022 have zero fatalities and cut serious injuries in half. And then, you know, number four, what will it take to achieve Vision Zero? You know, that's probably much more like research, resource focused.
Okay.
But I, you know, why don't I get back to you on that, because I don't know specifically.
Yeah, and I guess like maybe the feedback for you tonight is, in my mind, those two should be clearer, especially if they're guiding structure of the whole document, because you all need to really know how it's going to lay out an actionable plan. And if, you know, if you can't tell the purpose of one section from another, then it might also just make it for, it might be a fun read and it might be well formatted, but is it going to be something that is a real toolbox for you to help council make good funding decisions and for everyone to lay things out in the right schedules as you were describing? I mean, the scenario you gave is a reasonable one. When I was reading them, I thought three would be like the action steps that are in those other categories we talked about earlier, and four might be about budgeting or mm-hmm. about internal training capacity and other kinds of techniques rather than the actions themselves. But those are just your and my two different potential interpretations of this. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly when you guys come back to us with more information later on, we'll have a draft. We'll be able to give you feedback on how well that draft gets at the nitty-gritty of what we think is necessary to work with.
Definitely.
But definitely. Yeah.
Any other questions? Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, other business. I got a few items here. Anybody else have any before I got four items gonna run through here? No? Okay. One of them we had discussed in the past is representation of the Transportation Commission on the dashboard. And I was told that the retreat of the dashboard, which I believe is next month, right? Mm-hmm. That they were
October or November, and we're still finalizing that.
Oh, okay. That they were going to address that issue and see if they could actually add another member of the dashboard for a Transportation Commission representative, so it'd be good cross feed as opposed to you're on the dashboard representing the dashboard to the Transportation Commission. The Transportation Commission needs to have a representation on the dashboard. Anyhow, they said that that would be carried out there.
Before you go off that, could maybe staff send out to the TC the date of that once it's settled? The date of the retreat, once it's on the calendar.
Sure.
Okay. The other thing that I got a note on is the budget for this year. And so next month, the commission should take a hard look at what our priorities are, our top priorities that we think are important, and those priorities that are on the bottom. They ask us every year, and so give some thought to that. So next meeting we can provide some input to the city manager and council. Okay. The other thing is we had discussed is a public hearing section at the beginning of the Transportation Commission, and I'm going to bring that up for discussion and hopefully provide a resolution. And I think that actually I can make or ask for a resolution, but I think that the commission is representing the citizens of Alexandria, and I think it is only right that the citizens have an opportunity to present their views and give their feedback on what they think you know, the Transportation Commission should be addressing. And I think that, you know, that other commissions and City Council does that. And basically, we've had very few people actually come talk during our public hearing agenda items. And I don't think that's going to be a burden. So what I'll ask for is a resolution to have a public comment period at the beginning of the Transportation Commission. And it would be set up the same standards with 3 minutes for the public to comment on any item, not specifically, because we always have, if we're voting on something, we always have a public hearing for that particular issue. But I think we should have an open section there. So I'd like to present that, have somebody present that resolution, and then we can discuss it to see if that's something the commission feels that is appropriate, and go from there.
We do that at the beginning of every DASH meeting, and there's very little participation, but I think the important issue is the opportunity is there. So I would fully support making that a standing item on our
agenda. I think it's important, too. Yeah. We're just 11 people that represent the city, and, you know, it shouldn't be us making
decisions. Can't get all input from all
we
sources.
We need input, right. And we get very few letters on, you know, issues that come to light. Anybody else have any input?
I also think it's a great idea. Arlington has that as a standing item for its Transportation Commission.
Do they? Okay.
Just as a neighbor frame of reference. I think that, you know, the standard language is something akin to items not on the agenda, to make sure it's clear to the public who want to speak at that time that it isn't just extra soapbox time for things that will come up later. But I think it's optics as well as a functional way. I mean, in our agendas, we may only, like tonight, we had two main topics that we discussed. And they were updates, they weren't action items, but that was all we really had for the meat on the agenda tonight. But that may not be the only things going on, that may not be the only thing that's of particular concern to community members or organizations at a given time, and rather than wait for the right thing to come up at the right hearing, I think that having something like this at the beginning gives folks a chance to engage with us, even when it's not the, you know, perfectly aligned with our agenda.
I agree. Can I ask for someone to make a...
Mr. Chairman, kind of
input from staff here.
Yeah, just input for staff. You know, and I'm thinking specifically out of you know, the respect for staff time and everything. If we could maybe put a limit of 15 minutes or 10 minutes or something on it, that would.
Oh, on the total, in case we get,
yeah,
20 people in here.
That'd, yeah. And then you know, with the option to continue the public comment period at the end of. At the end of the meeting.
a public comment at the end also.
So if there's, yeah, basically what I'm saying is...
Continuation if we have time.
Yeah. If after 15 minutes there's still people who want to make public comments, they can
do it at the end
after the meeting.
Yeah, so they would come in and they'd submit their sheets, and you would call them up in order, but if we hit 15-minute mark, the ones who are later, and if you put that out there as the framework, then they know they better submit their sheet first if it's something else.
That's reasonable, and council should have done that long ago. I've been at council meetings that get out at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'll entertain a proposal to ask for...
Move to open each transportation commission meeting with a public hearing for no more than 15 minutes, each individual speaker limited to 3 minutes.
Right.
And then the overflow at the end of the meeting.
For items not on the agenda. It'd be general, general comments.
Not and specific. Do we have to be specific for items not on the agenda as public hearing items? I think probably we need to mention that because on our agenda we have all these update things which public can't comment on, but then we have a public hearing item that they can comment on. So I think what we want to say is for items not on the agenda for public hearing. That way they could, in this case tonight,
talk about something that's not even on the agenda.
Well, it means like if someone wanted to come and talk about the commercial parking standards process, they could because it's not a public hearing item, so they won't have another time to talk to us about it, even though it's on our agenda as an update.
Okay, that makes sense.
A clarification then. So if someone from the public's here tonight, because they're open to the public, the meetings, then if they wanted to provide input or an opinion, I'm just curious of what the rules are. I'm not sure I'm clear on what they are right now. If somebody would just attend it and they had an opinion or wanted to input, EPC, so like sometimes we'll get a couple people come in and usually we just ask them, we want to say something, and they just say something. So I'm just curious of what the...
Well, that's basically up to the chair. I've been pretty lenient because we rarely get anybody who wants to talk or to come to the meetings.
But I agree with the optics part. I mean, and I'm supportive of it. It'd be nice to have it on there. I just was wondering if somebody was here, if additional people were here tonight and they wanted to provide feedback or comment on the presentations we had tonight, how would that have been handled by the rules that it would just been up to?
Well, they'd just, at the beginning of the meeting, they'd submit.
She's asking about now.
Yeah, without.
Oh, about now?
Mm-hmm. How it would be handled.
Now, technically, they don't have an official opportunity
to speak at all. Okay. Yeah. Right.
And so if there were 20 people here who really wanted to talk about the commercial parking thing, then Jerry wouldn't have necessarily opened that can of worms because it might have caused an hour-long public hearing about it.
Yeah, that would.
So in that instance, providing something like this gives someone a formal way to know that they have a chance to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did I clear it up for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
If I move, do you need a second or no? And then discussion or no?
Yeah.
I'll second it.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any nays? Okay. Motion carried. So I think you can pretty much draft up what we discuss, and I would put that on the agenda for the next meeting. Okay. Last but not least, I'm moving, so it's moving faster there, so faster than I expected. So this most likely would be my last meeting. So I plan to resign as of the end of the meeting.
Where are you moving to?
North Carolina.
No.
Following my granddaughters.
Well, good for you.
So, anyway, it happened.
That's no reason to quit.
That's,
you can implement the teleconference option here.
Yeah.
You don't want to get the public comment.
Technology's the basis.
It is really.
We've been doing a lot of that FaceTime there. But I want to say that I really enjoyed the opportunity of sitting on the commission and chairing the commission. And I felt that the commission, not only myself, but the commission as a whole, has carried out as best we knew the wishes of our citizens to make this a better better place to live. You know, there's been a lot of things happening. Potomac Yard Metro Rail was a big step forward that the commission had to deal with, and Vision Zero, which actually started here with the commission. And those, you know, we've made some big steps there, and hopefully that, you know, the commission can, you know, continue with, you know, carrying out the wishes of the citizenry that we have and making it a safer place. So I've been honored to be a part of that, and everybody here on the commission and staff is, it's really worked smooth. And I hate to leave, but such is life sometimes, so we'll go from there. So I'll pass the...
Well, in my first official act, thank you very much for your dedication.
Well, yeah, I thought I'd have more time to think this over, but...
I can move quickly.
Yeah, well, the house sold real fast.
Well, it's good to know for us residents here.
Yes. So yeah, it was a good. I've been involved, you know, almost 20 years in Alexandria, and I've always been involved in volunteer work, trying to make this a better town to live in. So it's done well. So I appreciate everybody's support.
Thank you, Jerry.
Okay.
Thank you. And congratulations.
Yeah. Congrats. And to your grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I've got. Got one granddaughter, and the other one's coming in a week and a half. So.
Oh.
You better get it down.
I don't know when I'm moving, but middle October, looks like. So I'll be busy. I've been packing for 6 months, just in anticipation. So. Okay, thank you. Motion to adjourn.
Well, no, I just
you got one more?
Yeah, so the next meeting we expect to be in the council chambers, but as we all know with contractors, they sometimes take longer, so we might be here again next month.
In this?
Yes.
In this room, because the other one's booked too.
Probably, yeah.
That's the way it is. So. Yeah. No. It's like, you got to remember where to go.
Yeah.
You do a motion to adjourn?
Not to be a nag.
Seconded.
All right. All in favor?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
No nays. Nobody's going to
say. Jerry, best of luck. You're going to be missed. Yeah. You're going to be very missed, Jerry.
It's going to be tough.
Good luck, Jerry. Yeah.
Where in North Carolina? Woodburn.
Yeah. Right north of Cherry Point.
It is. No, my son works at Cherry Point. He works for the city at the GIS. And then
I went to fifth grade in Havelock.
Oh, fifth grade in Havelock. Okay.
My sister went to New Bern High School. That was some time ago.
Thank you
very much.
And I read in your paper about the purple line and your continuing efforts.
Right now, we're trying to save a safe route to school for all the children. I think we're going to hear from the judge.